The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
You're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org on the web. Welcome to Privacy Piracy. I'm Lloyd. I'm the show's engineer, and your host is Mari Frank. Mari's a local attorney and certified information privacy professional. She's the author of several books, including Safeguard Your Identity, From Victim to Victor, and The Complete Idiot's Guide to Recovering from Identity Theft. She's testified many times in Congress and the California legislature on privacy and identity theft issues. And you may have seen her on Dateline, 48 Hour, CNN, NBC, ABC, O'Reilly Factor, and many other shows, including her own 90-minute PBS television special, Protecting Yourself in the Information Age. To learn more about this radio show and our great guests, please visit kuci.org/privacypiracy. Hey, Mari, what's our show about today?
Well, Lloyd, today our show is about big data and efficiency, and we have a wonderful guest coming to us from the East Coast. Let me tell you a little bit about him. Edward Tunner is a distinguished scholar of the Smithsonian's Lummelson Center for the Study of Invention and Innovation, and he's a visiting scholar in the Rutgers University Department of History. He was a visiting lecturer at the Humanities Council at Princeton, and he has held visiting research positions at the Institute for Advanced Study and the University of Pennsylvania. His essays and reviews have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Atlantic, and much more. And he has given talks for many organizations, including Microsoft, AT&T, and many others. And he even had a TED Talk. His previous book, Why Things Bite Back, Technology and the Revenge of Unintended Consequences, written in part with a Guggenheim Fellowship, has been translated into German, Japanese, Chinese, Italian, Portuguese, and Czech. And we're going to be talking about his newest book, which is called The Efficiency Paradox, What Big Data Can't Do. So thank you so much for joining us, Edward.
Well, thank you very much, Mari.
Okay, so how come you decided to write this book?
I was looking at the trends that had been gathering steam since around 2005 when I signed a contract for a book on positive unintended consequences. And the more I looked, the more I saw that there were new positive as well as negative unintended consequences in the emergence of a constellation of the web that included mobile computing, big data, the cloud. It was all really part, and of course social media, so it was all really part of a second version of the web that had all kinds of new opportunities but also new problems. And what I saw was that many people were criticizing the emerging world, especially the role of social media, but they weren't looking at what I thought of as the main problem, which was that all these things were designed to make life more efficient, but if used to extremes, they could make us less efficient.
Right, right. And you talk about that you need to have a definition for what is efficient, right?
That's right.
Yeah. So how would you define what is efficiency?
Well, efficiency, I would say, is simply put, getting more for less, more miles per gallon, more light per watt, more words per minute. So that's really great. And so in that sense, it's very hard to criticize efficiency. Who would want to praise inefficiency? And this is true of progressives, too. They want energy efficiency. They want more efficient education. So it's something that cuts across political lines. But the problem that I see is that too much of it in the short term can deprive us of opportunities to become even more efficient in the longer term.
Right, right. So you called it the efficiency paradox, what big data can't do. What were your thoughts about that? Or I'm sure your publisher helped you with that title as well, but what were you thinking?
Well, that was my title.
Oh, even better.
I worked in publishing for 15 years. I was an acquisition editor. One of the things that editors are supposed to do is help authors with titles. So I had enough experience to know what would be a successful title. And in fact, all the titles of my books, I'm happy to say, are my own, just because I had to develop that knack. It actually started with one of the first books that I sponsored at Princeton called Why Big Fierce Animals Are Rare that became the basis of our popular science series.
Hmm. Fascinating. Okay, so so we talk about what big data can't do. You know, you talk about, in your preface, you kind of give us a hint of really the seven things, you know, that, well, the title of the preface basically is, excuse me, the seven deadly sins of efficiency. I love that.
So, oh, thank you.
So let's just kind of go over what those seven deadly sins. I think that's fascinating.
Well, thank you. It's hard for me, although I'm familiar with them.
I'll give it to you. I got them right.
Okay. Just go, because I don't usually think of them as a list in that way.
Right.
So if you name them, then I can elaborate.
Okay, exactly. Well, that's why I have them ready for you. Counter serendipity is the first one.
Counter serendipity just means that if people are always getting suggestions that are similar to what they've been watching, what they've been doing, they may be more satisfied, but they might be also depriving themselves of the opportunity to get to know something that's really different, that's unpredictable, and that could become an interest that was at least as great as the original interest.
Okay, so you think that it might even reduce creativity?
I think it would. It can narrow what people are reading, because the tendency, for example, of recommendation software is just to give you more and more of what you already want, and that is not a good way to enlarge your tastes.
Right.
I can tell you one story that independent bookstores or even chain bookstores can be a great source of serendipity. I once got a call long ago from John Kennedy Jr., who happened to see my first book in this series, Why Things Bite Back, in a bookstore while he was looking for another book. And he was really intrigued by the thesis, so he invited me to lunch, and I wrote a few articles for him. I don't think I would never have actually proposed writing for George Magazine, because I was not a political writer.
Right.
And yet there was something in my book that John saw that appealed to him. So I think a lot of opportunities come people's way when they happen to notice something or someone that they otherwise wouldn't, and that's also a defect of electronic dating sites, that they're so concerned with matching people, and so much of what happens to attract people is really more magical than algorithmic.
Right. You could go into the grocery store and you're both, you know, squeezing tomatoes or something, and there it is, right?
Exactly, and you can't do that with online shopping.
No, you can't do that. All right, the second one you had was hyper-focus, and that's kind of related to the first one too, huh?
Yes, it is. It's just the idea that you're concentrating so much on a certain goal that you are maybe ignoring some data that would also be relevant to the goal. It isn't the same thing as counter serendipity.
Right.
It's really that you can be too involved in a certain kind of quantitative question and not get the whole picture.
Right. Can't see the forest through the trees. right. How about this was a good one. Self-amplifying cascades. That was interesting.
Well, some researchers on web behavior have found that with social media and with other recommendation systems, very often what is ranked highest is really not because people would independently rank it highest, but because something or someone gets a head start.
Right.
And that start snowballs, but if people are given the chance to say, well, what do they really think is best, they would have a somewhat different order. So there is a kind of arbitrary benefit, and sometimes, of course, people who will use software to artificially inflate their initial advantage. So what you're getting is not the kind of natural organic selection of what people really like most, but what you're getting is a certain kind of biased selection.
Right, an algorithm selection. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, the next one is skill erosion. I thought that was interesting.
We see skill erosion as a risk, for example, in aviation, and of course the tragedies of the Boeing 737 MAX show how important it is that pilots be fully trained for all of the latest technology. Now that's expensive, and Boeing originally said that, well, you don't really have to have more than a brief training session, but pilots are always concerned about how automatic equipment, if you don't practice,
right,
will make it much harder to respond when there's some kind of glitch or failure in the automatic equipment and you
right
have to go back to manual operation.
Yes. And
by the way, that is something, that's something that is really relevant for so-called autonomous cars. That is, if
I was just going to bring that up.
Okay.
Good. Yeah, go ahead, because
read
my mind.
I think a lot of autonomous features are really great. For example, something that's available now, adaptive cruise control. When I'm using cruise control, it's frustrating because you're always creeping up on some car and then you have to disengage the control. But
right,
I think if people are able, for example, to cruise with confidence on long interstate drives, that's great. And automatic braking for a deer or a pedestrian is also terrific. So I'm for a lot of these autonomous features, but there's an idea going around that cars are going to be fully robotic. And even if that really works, and I have a lot of doubts about that for reasons I discuss in the book, even if that really works, one problem is that if people aren't really used to exercising their reflexes in driving day
right
after day, they may lose their ability to respond when there's some unforeseen situation. For example, whiteout conditions in snow, sometimes fog, the systems that are being developed, I believe, still can't detect potholes. So there are many things where drivers' reflexes will remain important, and if they are lulled into the idea that everything is going on robotically, there may be tragic results.
Yes. You know, I notice even with my car, which has that, you know, the stopping, there was something really wrong with it because it would stop when there was nothing there. It would, you know what I mean? So that's another thing.
Yeah, that's another problem of these systems.
Right.
They're sometimes defended by people who say, well, look at all of the accidents that are caused by human error. If you just eliminate that and you have a lower rate of computer errors, aren't you saving a lot of lives? And, you know, technically and statistically, that might be right. But try telling that to somebody who's grandmother has just been run over and say, well, don't be so selfish about it. Think of like two grandmothers have been saved because of this software.
Right.
And you have to have the big picture.
Right.
So I don't think that's going to work.
Right. There was recently a sheriff and his whole family that were killed here in California because there was some glitch with the automatic, protections that they had, so he couldn't stop the car, and oh my goodness,
also, well, that's awful. I didn't know about that.
Yeah. The next one you have is perverse feedback. This is interesting too.
Perverse feedback is when a system gives you an incentive. Sometimes a system is developed to give you an incentive to do something beneficial, but people will take advantage of it to actually defeat the purpose of it.
Right. Okay. Data deluge. Oh, that's a big one.
Well, information explosion is another way to say it, and I mean by that not only that people can be overwhelmed by the volume of statistics, but actually and paradoxically, our efficiency at gathering information can make it more expensive to store information for this reason. The sensors, for example, that are used in astronomy or many other data gathering systems are expanding geometrically in the volume of data that they're collecting. This is also true in medicine, whereas the cost of storing information on hard drives, for example, has been going down, but it's been going down more slowly. So we have a very unfavorable ratio of new information to the more slowly decreasing cost of storing the information, which means that the cost to society, to the companies at least, not so much to individuals now, but the cost to society can be increasing.
Yeah, you talk about false positives. I think about all the people who, let's look at something like credit reports, right? There's so many millions of credit reports, and you get these false positives. Someone looks like that they're an identity thief or something. They get them all mixed up, that there's, I think that's another aspect of the data deluge that, you know, it's not perfect. And
yes. No, that's
so,
one.
You
credit
know,
reports
could,
are one thing. And yeah. Also, the my big concern about that is facial identification. So the systems will often give facial identification in probabilistic terms, yeah, like 89%. But there could be, you know, 3 or 4 people who look enough like a suspect that they will all be pulled in. And some critics of big technology have even used the phrase automated suspicion.
Right. So, I would imagine you have some concerns then, as you talk about in your book, with biometrics instead of using passwords, you know, because passwords can be so overwhelming. And some people think, oh, you know, passwords, or I mean, bioidentification. And I know, like, when I open my iPhone 10 and it unlocks for me when I look at it. So, but there's some concerns about biometrics, isn't there?
Well, there are, although I should say that Apple has been pretty good about that, because the biometrics in Apple products, whether they're fingerprint or facial recognition, are actually built into the phone. Apple does not hold them in the cloud.
Right.
So it's going to be very hard for anyone to steal that. But if the information is in the cloud, then hackers can steal biometric information. You can always change a password, but you can't change your face. You can't change your fingerprinting. You know, maybe there are plastic surgeons somewhere who will do their best.
Remember in Minority Report, the movie, they had plastic surgeon change the eyes.
Well, exactly. Well, the big problem with that is that the companies that promote that like to create the impression that things are much more exact than they are. But if you read the fine print, you read their disclosures, you can see that it's really not so good, and that, you know, that in turn can lead to really complicate the relationship of citizens with the police, for example.
Right, right. I know that we've had issues with people with identity theft. It was hard enough when someone used their social security number or their passwords, but if, like you said, if their facial recognition or their iris scan or something else is taken and somehow it's corrupted or something, then, you know, you could have innocent people that are being charged. So that's
yes,
a scary
yes, and
thing.
Also automated suspicion applies to ancestry DNA services, where they're looking for a serial killer. So
right.
Your DNA, you know, shows you might be related to them. So lots of innocent people can get caught up in a dragnet like that. I certainly hope that any cousins of mine don't become serial killers and bring us all into disrepute.
Yeah, that's how they found a recent serial killer in California.
Exactly, yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, and then you talk about monoculture.
Monoculture just means that in the search for uniformity, people will often converge on, for example, one breed of plant or animal that seems to be most productive at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a certain kind of banana or tomato or apple, and this can be, in the short run, good for agriculture, good for prices, but of course it also means that a blight, a disease that affects these can become much more serious. And there was a very tragic case that everyone's familiar with in Ireland in the 1840s that was made worse by British policies and exploitation, but still it wouldn't have happened if the Irish hadn't been planting one variety of potato that seemed to be unusually productive, and all these potatoes were genetically identical, so when a blight came from South America, it wiped out a very large
right.
part of the crop.
Right, right. So let's switch gears a little bit, and you use the phrase continuous process and platform economy. Tell us what you're talking about, and can you give some examples?
There's a really great visual metaphor of the change in industry in my native Chicago. There's a large building on the lakeshore that was called the Calumet Building, still maybe. And when I was growing up, that was the printing plant of R.R. Donnelly that still exists throughout the Midwest, but then they were concentrated there. And R.R. Donnelly printed phone books, Sears Roebuck catalogs, Life magazines. They were really taking advantage of the ability of very high-speed presses to convert rolls of paper into finished books and publications. And the building was constructed with excellent electrical supplies. The frame was reinforced. It was really a fantastic building. But in the 1990s, Donnelly was printing fewer things. They were moving their printing elsewhere. And the building was sold, and it has now been converted into one of the world's largest server farms,
uh-huh.
where all that electricity and the reinforced construction are very helpful. So to me, that's a metaphor of going from a world where mm-hmm. things are kind of, when you look at, for example, pictures of the films of the city in the early 20th century, especially in the 1920s, you see milk being filled automatically with rotary this and that. There were all these rotary systems
yeah.
that were giving people a continuous stream of consumer goods. And now a lot of that, some of that still goes on, of course, but now the edge of technology is more these services that are managed by large centralized server farms and will let people order without a Sears catalog. So instead of having the Sears catalog printed in the Donnelly plant actually may be processing some orders on the web through Amazon or other companies.
Yeah, fascinating. Yeah, I'm originally from a suburb of Chicago, so I'm one. We're Midwesterners, right?
Yes, yes. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you if you drove on the on Lakeshore Drive. But I'm sure you've seen that building, and it really always fascinated me even before the change.
Right. So you talk in the book about how Thomas Edison's career illustrates both, you know, the dark side and the light side of the search for efficiency. Tell us about that.
Well, Edison was the inventor not only of the light bulb, as is usually called, but of a really efficient system for generating and distributing electricity. He didn't just have one thing. He had a whole system. The system was really financially set up so that it could be sustainable. He was really great at financial backup for what he was doing, and he had many other inventions. For example, the dictating machine that made for more efficient office operation. But he really didn't understand how important it was to waste resources sometimes. So when he had a successful film company, but when the age of feature films was coming on with stars and multiple reels, his advisor, who called himself an efficiency engineer, said, well, you should really not have too many retakes. You should have a high ratio of film stock shot to actual films, and that was not a very good formula, and he sold his company a few years later. Edison also thought that education was really inefficient, and that by using a special machine for projecting films that he made of scientific principles, that he could really help students learn much more quickly. But that venture failed too, and one reason for that was that Edison, like the great majority of people who have thought of revolutionizing schools, the one thing nearly all of them have had in common is that none of them has ever actually taught a class.
Right, so it's all theory and not practice.
Yeah, I mean, it's all a kind of projection of what it must be like to teach based on their experiences in school. But the actual job of teaching is a much more complicated one, and it is hard to do efficiently in the sense of conventional industrial efficiency.
Right. Well, believe it or not, we are out of time. So I just want to make sure I, again, say the name of your book, which is wonderful, The Efficiency Paradox, What Big Data Can't Do, Edward Tenner. And Edward, we can just give your website, and then it's time to go.
Well, thank you. The website is just edwardtenner.com.
Okay, so it's T-E-N-N-E-R.
EDWARDTENNER.com.
Okay, thank you so much. So keep in touch. We will be interested in your next book, too. So thank you so much.
Thanks. I am starting to work on it right now.
Oh, perfect. Okay, let us know. Okay, thank you. You've been listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org on the web. Thank you so much for joining us. Join us every Monday morning at 8 a.m. and visit our website at privacypiracy.org. Thanks.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.